The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2011 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2011. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the Internet. If you would like to find out more about the work of ACCS, please visit our website at www.accsedu.org. To order additional talks from this conference, please visit the ACCS website and click on Conferences. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
All right, we're going to get started. Thank you for coming on this last day of the conference. If you're like me, you have a 7-hour drive ahead of you, so I appreciate the dedication to stay for the last talks. I'm going to start by sharing with you my favorite quotation from C.S. Lewis, which comes in The Horse and His Boy. Talking horse Bree is having a conversation with the Colombian princess Erebus, and they are on the run and taking a break. Bree said, "And now, Tarquina, tell us your story, and don't hurry it. I'm feeling comfortable now." And Lewis says, "Erebus began immediately, sitting quite still and using a rather different tone and style from her usual one. For in Colormine, storytelling, whether the stories are true or made up, is a thing you're taught, just as English boys and girls are taught essay writing. The difference is that people want to hear the stories, whereas I never heard of anyone who wanted to read the essays." I've spent several years now reading the essays, and I can attest the truth in general of what Lewis says. But we all know that there are George Orwell's, Dorothy Sayers, Wendell Berry's, and yes, C.S. Lewis's in this world, and they write essays that people want to read. So the point of this talk is to ask, what's the process like to try to get your students to come up with a 20 to 50 page paper that people will want to read? When my students graduate, they often go off to Hillsdale and Grove City. Those are the two colleges that we seem to be a farm school for. And Hillsdale, at least, requires a senior thesis. I have a PhD in classics, but until I wrote my dissertation, I never had to defend anything. Job interviews came later. I never had to sit down and get grilled in my life until all of a sudden it happened with my thesis. So I think we can provide some valuable life experience by giving students senior thesis in the course of their classical Christian education. So let me take a brief survey here. Who is slated to teach senior thesis next fall? Okay. And keep your hand up if it's for the first time. Okay. So you should be sitting in the front, right? On the anxious bench. Okay. And raise your hand if you're an administrator who is looking into instituting senior thesis. Okay. All right. So this is billed as practical tips. I'm going to take you through our process that we use at Mars Hill. It's one I've been doing for the past 5 years, but it started a little bit earlier with another teacher. And I'm going to share with you all the things I've learned, the mistakes I've made, so that you don't have to make them yourself. What do we do? 3 months of research, 1 month of writing, a public oral presentation, and the so-called viva voce exam by a panel of live questioners. The senior thesis is designed to be the last hurdle, the final rite of passage after 11 and a half years of classical Christian education. So if you look in your notebook, you find the outline for the talk, which I'll be following pretty closely. There's also a handout packet that my wife should have given you as she came in the door. It has some documents that I'll be referring to and that might serve as useful templates for you. The first thing we need to get a student to write a worthy thesis is an advisor to coach and help them along the way. And that is a distinct thing from the thesis teacher, you or me. If you've got 7, 10, 15, 20 students in your thesis class, you cannot be the advisor for all of them. You're going to need each of them to have some other interested, available adult to meet with and interact with about their paper. And you'll get a sense after a year or two who is a good advisor and who is a dud. There's certain faculty members that I will not give a student to be a senior thesis advisor. There are others that I know, if I've got a weak student, this person can turn a silk purse out of a sow's ear. I can really help these students by giving them the right advisor. And the first thing you see on your packet of documents is the advisor form. Advisors don't know what they're to do. They need to be debriefed. You need to describe their job to them a little bit. And so that's what this form does. But it's not a substitute for you actually meeting with the advisors and filling them in. What is this process like? What am I expecting from you? Some of them will come to the table with an assumption that they shouldn't be helping the student all that much, that the student has to come up with all the arguments and the advisor's job is simply to read their stuff and critique it. But at least at our school, I find it perfectly fine for the advisor to help supply the student with arguments. The student has to understand them and articulate them himself, but that's part of the advisor's job too. Sometimes the student doesn't bother to see his advisor. The student needs to drive this process because you're in a triangular relationship. There's the advisor, there's the student, and there's you, the thesis teacher. You don't want the process to be one of you calling and emailing with the advisor and the student never goes and sees him. The student needs to be seeing the advisor regularly. And so it helps to script in some automatic checks to make that happen. The next page in your packet on the back of the first one is the advisor progress checklist, which I give about midway through the process as the student's about to start writing the thesis proper. But I also require every student to get their advisor's signature or initials on any papers that they're turning in to me, whether it's their bibliography or preliminary papers on related subjects or the drafts of the thesis itself. The advisor has to sign everything. This prevents disaster, which can happen when a student does not take the initiative to see their advisor. Next thing you need is a topic for a paper. I'm aware that different schools do this differently. I know of one that has the same topic for every student. It simply assigns everyone to write on what is a good life for a Christian. That's a worthy topic. But at Mars Hill, we allow the students latitude to choose their own. We figure they're going to be engaged in this for 5-6 months, and therefore it's in their interest to have something they are interested in, that they can sustain and enjoy working on. Anyone of you who has written a thesis know that no matter how interested you are in it at the beginning, you will become bored of it by the end. So better to be very interested. Students have limited experiences. They're only 18 years old. They're not full of wisdom, necessarily. Some of them are wise beyond their years, but others are not. And therefore, you want to make sure that the student doesn't try to fly too high. Theses on topics that require a master's degree before you're really qualified to write them are best left for PhD dissertations. Highly philosophical theses that involve deep waters and great metaphysical questions, you need to make sure that the student has the maturity and the intellectual caliber to tackle such a topic. One of the ways that I do that is in the preliminary paper stage. Students write 3 or 4 preliminary papers before they even get to the thesis. The preliminary papers are 5 to 10 pages long, and they're on a variety of topics. I'll get to that in a second. But the student who wants to write an ambitious topic has to show me in the preliminary papers that he has what it takes to tackle that topic. And if it's clear that he doesn't, then we'll shift the thesis a little bit, change the topic so that it's something more manageable. A thesis is an interesting and controversial statement requiring argument and evidence to persuade an audience to accept it, and it should be something that's sufficiently treatable within 20 to 50 pages, because you don't want to be reading more than that. 3 drafts of the thesis with a class of 10 means you're looking at around 1,000 to 1,500 pages of reading, probably within the space of a month and a half. And that's pretty onerous, especially if you have other classes. I know it's pretty typical that those of you who are thesis teachers are probably humanities or omnibus teachers, too, and that requires essays and grading. So do yourself a favor, put a cap on the size, because some students will just continue to crank it out. Here's some examples of theses that we've had in the past 4 years. And I picked these because they're examples of theses that could have been weak or problematic, but they succeeded because we shaped the process a little bit and coached them as they went along. About 4 years ago, I had a student who loved reading People magazine to get the latest news on Princess Diana, Lady Gaga, whatever other celebrities were out there doing drugs and fornicating and generally making fools of themselves. So she came to me and said, I want to do my thesis on Princess Diana. And after taking a deep breath, I said, well, we'll see about that. And fortunately, I found her a great advisor who majored in journalism and had some expertise in media studies. And so we turned that thesis around and made the student examine her own habits. So her thesis ended up being, infatuation with the latest news about Princess Diana or Lady Gaga is a dangerous substitute for real relationships. She had to think about what she was doing. Another thesis, suicide out of despair is always immoral, tending toward an ethical conclusion. This is a thesis that started out wanting to simply preach, but when I took the student to the Bible and we started looking at passages and looking at the Christian tradition and looking at Jewish ethics, also based on Old Testament scripture, one finds that condemning suicide to court is not so easy and requires theologizing, like Aquinas does, to arrive at a total prohibition. So this was a thesis that then involved her in looking at original text, looking at original languages, looking at the Christian tradition and the history of theology. Another ethical thesis. The fourth commandment is of perpetual force, and Sabbath obligation is supported by natural law. This was a thesis that grew out of a very bright student's reading of the New Testament in Greek with me, and her struggles to reconcile what she heard from me and what she seemed to be seeing in the text, things like, let no one judge you in respect of a new moon or Sabbath day, or you are observing days, seasons, and years, I fear for you lest I have labored in vain, trying to reconcile these verses with her family's own Reformed Sabbatarian tradition. She ended up arguing that human nature and physiology, the way we're made, our sleep cycles, require a 6+1 work and rest pattern. So she was looking at things like the Soviet Union trying to institute a 10-day week, and looking back in ancient history to see if anybody else had odd non-7-day weeks. Her research also led her to Richard Gaffin's master's thesis on Calvin and the Sabbath, and to rereading the Reformers and the Church Fathers, and seriously grappling with the original Greek of the relevant New Testament passages. Last example. The right of self-defense and the accompanying right to bear arms presupposes a Christian society with Christian definitions of rights and laws. This started out also as what was going to be too simple a thesis. Just beat on the Brady Society, I think it's called, and the other gun control organizations, and expose their fallacious arguments. Well, that's a worthy goal, but when you start to look at their arguments, you realize it's like shooting fish in a barrel. They really aren't all that strong, and it's not really thesis worthy to simply refute them. So we had to make the thesis more complicated and involve some more interesting research. I pointed out that the entire gun control debate now revolves around safety and individual self-defense. The only question we're asking is, are kids going to kill themselves when they're fooling around with daddy's gun? Have we got enough safety locks on it? Or if you're threatening me, can I whip out the gun that I'm toting and defend myself? But, of course, the Second Amendment makes no mention of those questions. The Second Amendment, as the founders understood it, is about resisting tyranny. And so we turn the student to Blackstone and Aquinas to get some Christian background into the idea of self-defense, and then also to some Reformed documents about resisting tyranny and original comments and letters and essays by the founders about what they understood the Second Amendment to mean. Okay. So we see some keys to successful theses. You got to question the obvious, avoid simple-minded theses, go to the original sources. If your student has foreign languages like Hebrew, Greek, or Latin, use them. They will make compelling arguments using those. If you flip to the very back page of your packet, you will find an amusing little cartoon, Life Before Google. Two cuddly animals on the couch. I just thought of something I'd like to know more about. That's a dang shame. Trying to get sources in a modern age. If you're like us, your school library has lots of Chronicles of Narnia and very few scholarly journals. You are not a major research library. You probably don't have access to JSTOR. Although I do know the competing big Christian school in Cincinnati does have access to JSTOR. My predecessor as a thesis teacher at Mars Hill was engaged in law school at the same time that he was teaching. He had access to JSTOR. So if you have these resources, more power to you. Otherwise, you're going to have to avail yourself, sometimes creatively, of what libraries there are in your area. Cincinnati happens to have a very excellent public library system, which its holdings rival some major university libraries. Check around. You may find that seminary libraries and university libraries will be willing to loan books to students with special card, usually for 2-3 weeks, and that may be sufficient. If student doesn't get good sources, it will spell disaster. So this is one of the things that you need to get the advisors on immediately. The first meeting that I have the students have with their advisors is to ask the advisor, what are the landmarks of scholarship? The things that changed the way people think about economics or sociology or whatever the topic is that we're engaged with. And so if a student is engaged in an economics thesis, the advisor is probably going to point them to read a little bit of Adam Smith or Bastiat or Friedman. If they're engaged in a psychology thesis, then pointing them to Freud. Doesn't mean that they're going to have to read The Entire Wealth of Nations or Interpretation of Dreams, but it does mean that they should dip into these things and be familiar, at least, with some of what has set the stage for later scholarship. Computers are a blessing and a curse. We type on them, but the things that we type have no permanence. They're infinitely editable. They also, if you're doing internet research and you have a connection or Wi-Fi signal in your classroom, that brings with it accompanying potential distractions, Facebook, YouTube, ESPN.com, video games. So make clear to the students that use of the internet on class time is to be for class purposes. In order to track the development of the research, I require students to submit an annotated bibliography periodically throughout the research process. By annotation, I simply mean, give me one or two sentences stating what use each book was for your thesis. What was the relevance? What data did you get out of it? And then finally, using class time, you need to be on top of this because until about the last month, the students may not feel the urgency of senior thesis and may think that this is time to do calculus homework. So make clear, thesis time is thesis time. All right. If you look at your outline, we're ready to embark on production of the thesis, the writing process. One semester to make everything happen. Some schools don't even make it a class. They just piggyback it onto the omnibus or humanities class. Raise your hand. Does your school give a whole year for thesis? Yeah? Okay. Raise your hand if you have a semester. Oh, okay. More of you have a year. Okay, you can stretch this process out. I kind of wish I had a year sometimes. At any rate, boundaries need to be in place. You should communicate with other teachers in the school, let them know when the deadlines are going to be, so you don't get this he said, she said, sort of whiny bargaining about homework. You can't have us do any reading for Monday. That's when Mr. Colvin has a thesis draft due. No. Preliminary papers are the next step in the process. They've been reading for about a month. Now it's time to write some things. And with luck, these preliminary papers will frequently survive, or large portions of them will survive, to be rolled into the final thesis. Some topics for preliminary papers. I often have students do a survey of literature. What are the paradigm books that they need to read? In media studies, they need to read some Neil Postman, Marshall McLuhan. In economics, Adam Smith. Don't try to be exhaustive. Aim for books that will give them exposure to important Christian thought and provide them with ways of thinking that are profitable for addressing the topic. Second kind of thesis, preliminary paper, factual research. You'll have students that want to do sociological papers or economic papers, and they need statistics. They need to know what was the divorce rate in the 1950s or how many people were killed by guns each year. What does the Constitution say about coining money? So go to the original sources, too. What does Blackstone say about taxation? Where does Augustine elaborate his just war theory? Was John Calvin really a Sabbatarian? So go to the sources. That's a second kind of preliminary paper. Third kind, very valuable, devil's advocate paper. Force the student to write from the opposing perspective so that they can give the best argument to their opponents. What are the best arguments that a Marxist or Seventh-day Adventist or framework hypothesis advocate could come up with? This will prevent the student from arguing against straw men when he gets to his real thesis. And finally, special theories that apply. I'm talking about whole paradigms of ways of looking at the world that might shed light on a particular issue for a thesis. So a neo-Calvinist or Dojaverdian creation for redemption theory, or technological determinism in communication, or Walter Ong's orality and literacy, or have him read Peter Leithart on hermeneutics, medieval quadriga. F. Carolyn Graglio's Domestic Tranquility, A Brief Against Feminism. So you want the students to be reading not just landmarks of scholarship, but also, if you can, more recent, provocative books that will shift their paradigm and help them to come at their topic from a more interesting perspective. Then we move on to writing the thesis paper itself. I have students write three drafts. If you have the luxury of doing a whole year thesis class, you could have more drafts than that. I find that some of us are gifted with the ability to simply talk in complete, rational, logical sentences and construe an argument, and there you go. The rest of us have to write. So the first draft is thinking on paper. Students need to put their ideas outside their own heads and in an external form that they can interact with them. Unfortunately, I wish this were not true, but you probably will have some students whose English mechanics are so bad that it precludes them from easy, logical thought. Senior thesis is the last hurdle. There have been 11 and a half years of education prior to it. So a student who cannot write well is going to do poorly in thesis class. There is no magic bullet for this problem. Three drafts, one to formulate, one to revise, one to polish English style, and revise some more. Be a stickler for good writing. I have a baseline rule. I will not give an A to any senior thesis that has more than two comma splices in it. That doesn't mean that I have to copy edit the previous two drafts. All it means is I have to notice, wow, this person's abusing commas every paragraph. I just put a note. You fix your comma usage. It's their job to copy edit the paper, or their parents. Insist upon good style. Demand explanatory metaphors, vivid descriptions, interesting anecdotes, brevity, conciseness, punch. If you do not raise the bar and insist upon good style, you will not want to read the 1,500 pages of essays. If you insist upon good style, there will be joys for you in reading the 1,500 pages of essays. Next section is evaluation. Two things, public oral presentation and the defense, not to be confused with each other. Public oral presentation is modeled on a medieval disputatio. A student stands forth to present their thesis, and then after half an hour of speaking, they will entertain questions from the audience, which can be on anything relevant to the thesis. So they need to be coached a little bit. I give them a trial run-through in class. It's not graded. This is your practice time to deliver your thesis orally. It should not be a mere reading of the written thesis. I force the students to boil down their thesis to something that's speakable in 30 minutes and that is a little livelier and looser, that doesn't sound like someone reading prose because we don't speak the same way that we write. The classmates will give them feedback, I'll give them feedback, and then they'll revise and be ready to do it for the school. Because there is no limit to what can be asked from the audience, the student needs to be prepared to say, well, temperatures on Mars are outside my scope of research. I didn't really look into that. They also need to be prepared to say, that's a really good question, and I will have to look into it. As they're giving their public presentation, I'm taking notes of what all the questions were, and immediately afterwards, you see near the end of your handout, there is sheet that looks like this. Some numbers to circle. I'm grading their presentation in real time, and they're graded on their delivery. You all know, if you have students giving speeches for you, what a horrible trap it is to be reading from a script. It's like flypaper. You can't gesture anymore. Ah! Right. So they have a choice. They can either memorize their speech so that their hands are free and their eyes are on the audience and their faces engaged and communication becomes much easier, especially after 4 years of practice giving rhetoric school speeches. They can do that and earn the carrot that I dangle before them of 5% bonus points. Or they can not do it, and they have a maximum grade of a 95. So we have a stick and a carrot. I also coach the students to avoid PowerPoint effect. PowerPoint effect is when I have the same message coming at you in two different ways, so that you're hearing it and your eyes are reading the text off the screen. Apologies to Pastor Balcom. Studies have shown that your audience will retain less of what you communicate when it comes at them in more than one way. Pick one. That doesn't mean that they can't show things, use visual aids. If they're discussing statistics and they have a graph, great. That's something that can go up. If they're analyzing a great painting or showing a movie clip that they're talking about in their thesis, that would be appropriate to put up on the screen. But propositional, discursive argumentation needs to be coming from their mouth, and they are the visual aid, not the screen. I hope you're writing down any questions because we are going to have some time to discuss them. Last part of the evaluation is the defense or viva voce exam. Students have their own apprehensions about this process. This is a cartoon done by one of my students prior to her defense. Kiss the cook. At any rate, you know that there are few things less pleasant than being grilled. Therefore, you need to make it fair for your students, and you need to give them every opportunity to succeed. One of the highlights of my teaching career was when one of my best students had gone off to college. She went to Hillsdale, and she recently graduated, took a job back at her high school, so she's a colleague now, but she graduated and she had to do a senior thesis. She graduated valedictorian at Hillsdale. And she was such a high-powered student that she wrote her senior thesis in her junior year. And she wrote me back. She did a thesis on the Book of Ruth. She wrote me back after it was done. She'd been examined by her three Bible professors. And she said, it was wonderful. It was like a conversation among peers. They honored me by asking my opinion about things, and I was able to teach them because I had done sufficient research into my topic. And I was very happy to hear this. It really made my day to hear that she had had a good thesis experience. And that's what it's like when a student has followed the process properly and done their research well and has a worthy thesis. I had a very successful defense student, had a highly controversial thesis that he wrote for me. He had been an intern at a genetic engineering lab in Cincinnati the previous summer, and he's now studying to go to med school. He knew from the time he was a freshman that that's what he wanted to do. So he had background and deeper knowledge than most people would of his thesis topic. That's always advantageous. But his thesis was that Christians should not merely allow genetic modification of the human body, but that they should engage in it, that this is an obligatory thing that Christians should be pursuing. And, of course, he presented this to me at the beginning of the semester, and I said, you're nuts. And I handed him C.S. Lewis's Abolition of Man and said, look at what Lewis says will happen if we allow the master scientists to engineer the human body, especially if they engineer the human mind. And so his entire semester was a process of arguing against me and writing preliminary paper, refuting C.S. Lewis's Abolition of Man. Not all of it, but one particular argument. And so he had an uphill climb, and it was a difficult process. But at the end of the day, there was no argument that he could not anticipate. And he just regaled his three examiners with his mastery of his subject matter and his anticipation of every objection. Examiners, three of them, should be sitting on each exam. I have had students in the past who, because they were uber confident, requested more examiners than three. They wanted their pastor to come and quiz them. I find that it is difficult to have a good exam with more than three. Too many cooks spoiling the broth, too many different directions to try to pursue. We draw our examiners from the school community. There's a couple of pastors, some lawyers, parents. The basic criterion is not, do you have an expertise in the student's subject matter? That's not necessary. This is a jury of peers, a jury of members of the Christian community that the student is seeking to enter with this rite of passage as a full adult. It's important to recognize that there will be differing theological perspectives on each panel. I remember when my student who did a thesis on the Sabbath, actually, she wrote the thesis on the weekdays, but on the topic of the Sabbath, when she was doing her defense, it was known to her ahead of time, you have one staunchly anti-Sabbatarian examiner, and you have another staunchly Sabbatarian examiner. And I came to those two examiners ahead of time and said, here's your job. You're supposed to be giving an exam to the student. It's not time for you two to bicker amongst yourselves. So clarify the process for anyone who may be unclear about it and make sure that they're all on the same page. Another student I had wrote a thesis on worship music, and this was actually before I became a thesis teacher. I was an examiner on his panel, and I'm an Anglican. I enjoy traditional hymnody with organ or other instruments. And another examiner on the panel was an RPCNA exclusive psalmist, no instruments, only a cappella advocate. And the student came to me and joked, my strategy for this defense is that of the Apostle Paul. I'm going to stand up like he did and say, brethren, I'm a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. It's because of the resurrection of the dead that I'm on trial before you today, and then just watch you two fight. Right? And That exam had other issues because there were six examiners, but we did refrain from quarreling amongst ourselves. So examiners need direction, and the way to do this is to have a 15-minute meeting before the actual exam. The exam is about 45 minutes long, 15 minutes everybody sits down and powwows. You, the thesis teacher, direct the powwow. Ask everybody, what did you think was question-worthy? What do you want to see pursued in this exam? Get it all down on paper, apportion out the jobs, say, okay, you're going to ask for definitions of terms. There's a handout in the packet which gives some guidance about the sorts of questions that we're looking for. And we really divide the evaluation in three categories, knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. Knowledge category is definitions of terms and research into facts. Did you look at all the sources that you needed to? Do you know what you're supposed to know in order to speak about the topic? Understanding is the logic of the paper. Do you understand the connections between your arguments? Do you understand the entailments? Do you know the trajectories and the implications that your thesis may have? And then wisdom, did you consult necessary Bible passages? Are you thinking like a Christian? Are you exercising judgment? Are you being a radical and just buying any argument you can construct? Are there any constraints on where your intellect is taking you? Are you being spiritual? So as the exam progresses, someone may ask a probing question. Right, somebody did an economics thesis. I want to know if they have read any Adam Smith. Do they understand the concept of the invisible hand? So I ask them a question. What causes supply and demand to be met, to be in equilibrium? Student doesn't know. Does God make that happen? Student's still not getting where I want him to go. Not coming up with Adam Smith or the invisible hand. We might ask the question one more time, but that's it. We don't leave the student dangling at the end of their noose and say, okay, we'll just note it down. Student didn't know some piece of information we really wanted them to know. That doesn't mean they're going to fail their defense. It does mean that we're probably going to tell them at the end of it, you need to look into this. It's a relevant concept. And then you move on, so that the student isn't made to feel extra uncomfortable not knowing this one answer. Show pastoral sensitivity. This is the last item on the handout. Some examiners are going to come on like bulldogs. It is not a contest to see whether you're smarter than a fifth grader, so to speak, or than a senior. Examiners need to consider the student's frame. Some students are not as talented as others. Some are able to think in very high-powered, complex ways. Others are more simple and straightforward. And this may mean that you, the thesis teacher, as you're directing the defense, may want to rule some questions off limits, may want to rephrase other questions in a simpler way for the student to grasp them more easily, may want to even prompt the student. I've done this on occasion. If I know that the student has had some background reading, knows some fact from a previous class that I taught them, has read something in their worldview capstone class or theology class that bears on this issue, I will gently prompt and remind them and see if they can make the connection and articulate it for themselves. Of course, I'll let them try to do it on their own before I prompt, but better to toss them that line and see if they can help themselves out. Remember that senior thesis is a pretty big hurdle. And so giving every student the best opportunity for success is important. And just as I give every student a trial or mock presentation time in class to practice their speech, so I also arrange, usually 6 days before the actual panel defense, I give them a mock exam in class. Myself and usually one other teacher, we've got a couple of fellows who have suffered examinations themselves, had PhDs or master's degrees, we will sit down and give the student a mock defense exam. And they find that this is extremely useful. They can write down all the questions that we ask. They can get an idea of where they stand. Do they need to be scurrying in the next 6 days to shore up weaknesses and find out things that they should have done research on and didn't? They'll know that after the mock exam. Well, one of the things that makes senior thesis effective as a sort of rite of passage and a cure, a surefire cure for senioritis. Students who have one foot in the next life, college, are made to think about their senior year and do some diligent work. But one of the things that makes it effective at this is the fact that there is a passing and a failing. There's a crisis. There's a decision at the end of the road. And students do fail. I've had usually about 20% do not pass their defense of Mars Hill. What does this mean? Does it mean we say, oh, okay, stamp them with not for Purdue and toss them in the ash heap? No. Now, if those parents have paid 11 and a half years of tuition, you're not at liberty to simply say, okay, you flunk. But it does mean that the student is going to have to spend that last week between the defense and graduation shoring up some weakness in their thesis. And usually that's in the form of a remedial paper. So if you wrote a thesis on the Sabbath, but you did not consult John Calvin's view of it, maybe we'll have you write a paper just on John Calvin. 5 pages, you can get it done, turn it into me, and then you walk. That's a bummer. You wanted to simply be looking forward to graduation. But you had some more work to do because you didn't pass your defense. But, on the other hand, students have been in this pressure cooker for a semester, and they have sat for a defense. At the end of the defense, I ask them to leave the room. We're going to deliberate for 10 minutes, go take a stroll, come back, and we'll tell you how you did. And when the news is good, there's congratulations. There are tears of gratitude and joy. There are people skipping down the hallway and clicking their heels like Mary Poppins. There are people giving hugs to each other. There's a real sense of accomplishment because they have done a piece of creditable work that was difficult. And they've had their success sealed by a panel of respected Christian adults. So that's the process. I think we've got about 20 minutes for questions or comments. So, in a green shirt. The question was, if you're a school that doesn't have seniors yet and you're expecting to add senior thesis or have something like this in the senior year, what can you do in the grades leading up to senior year to prepare students for it? And my answer is, well, we do term papers. We do the George Grant 40-hour project for all our omnibus classes. And that's not a senior thesis. It's more like 10, 15 pages. But the research process is frequently similar. I guess the main difference is that for a senior thesis, I would take students on a field trip to the library, maybe more than once, and they would also be responsible for digging up their own sources and following the track of bibliography. It's not enough to just grab the sources that I recommend, but they also need to look in the bibliographies of those sources and see if there are anything that would help. Whereas for a 40-hour project or something for an omnibus class, I'm probably simply handing them the sources and they're not having to do gopher work in the library. But I find that because I require a real thesis, it's not just a book report, it's not just a biography report, it's not a narrative, because those omnibus papers, those term papers, also include an oral presentation and a visual display, sometimes, and have to have a thesis, they're good preparation for writing a senior thesis. Other questions? I should add that we have had very small classes. The largest class so far has been 10, and we'll have another 10-student class this coming year. So we have had the luxury of doing it over the course of usually 3 or 4 days. It is advertised in our the Highland Times, the Mars Hill parent newsletter that goes home every week, and it's open to the public. anybody off the street can come in and listen to senior thesis public presentations. They take one period, so the last three periods of the day. Most of our heavy academics are done in the morning, so there's things like choir and art and foreign languages. Not that those aren't serious, but those are in the afternoon, and they get preempted by senior thesis for about 4 days. Does that answer?
Okay. Yes, be loud. Can you talk to us just a bit about how you motivate students during the process? You talked about the fact that it's not the last month that someone gives the urgency. We've had constant struggle with that, trying to get the kids to realize that it's not the best thing for out and taking advice and making changes.
So what sort of lack of motivation are you seeing?
For instance, they meet the advisors. The advisors say, fix this, fix that. And
I did have a student who had a similar attitude this past year. He was kind of a C, low B student anyway, not very motivated, had never been very motivated. And he actually, I had actually done a little bit of copy editing on his second drafts and circles and things, misspellings, typos, and he didn't bother to fix them on the third draft. He just turned in the same thing. And so obviously grades are part of it, but as you would probably point out, you got a senior. They don't care about their grades anymore. They've already applied to colleges. They've already been accepted by colleges. And it's a dead letter, lame duck term. There's not a whole lot you can do in some instances. I do warn them, you are cruising for a very unpleasant oral exam. You're going to get really hard questions from your audience because you have not done your work. The public presentation is going to be a fiasco. They don't want to be embarrassed, so I think that's a stick that you can use. But you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. A lazy senior with an acute case of senioritis, they're going to reap the rewards of that. There's a question is, what's the proportion of primary to secondary sources? Because we're only dealing with one semester, and because this is not a PhD dissertation, and I should add, what are the antecedents of senior thesis? Well, partly it's modeled on medieval universities, disputatio. Partly it's modeled on German university system, the 18th and 19th centuries, which persists to this day. R.L. Dabney has a neat little essay called The Effect of the German University Model on Theological Literature. And one of the things he points out is that the German university model has as its goal to increase the store of human knowledge and to make progress and make and do new work, right? Make a new contribution, say something that hasn't been said before. And that isn't necessarily the point of senior thesis. The point is education. We're trying to form students, give them some skills, have them exercise their minds on an intellectual project. So it is not important to me whether the student's conclusions are novel or not, so long as the arguments are good and they understand them and can articulate them themselves. And since that's the case, I would rather have them read primary sources almost exclusively than get bogged down in secondary sources. That said, secondary sources are valuable because they shed light on the primary sources, and so students always have some, but I do put a premium on primary sources. Yes?
Do you provide your examiners with an abstract or with actual paper?
The examiners get the actual paper and have to read it. I have done abstracts in past years. I failed to do it by an oversight this year. And the main people who wanted abstracts were the publishers of the parent newsletter who wanted to put them in. So I'm going to make sure I do that next year. It's a good idea.
Even if they do get to a point where they understand it, have nothing
we're a confessionally reformed school. The Westminster Confession is the standard for doctrine teaching in the school. And most of our students are flaming Calvinists, cage stage Calvinists, especially the Reformed Baptists of the bunch. But I had a student go Arminian on us in the defense. And I made clear to the examiners, so that there's 15 minutes of planning time, 45 minutes of defense, and then 15 minutes of postmortem and figure out what the assessment is. I made clear to the examiners in the assessment time. It was a surprise to all of us. Nobody expected the student was Arminian, or had semi-Pelagian almost. Nobody expected that, and so it was a surprise. And I made clear to them, look, we all disagree with his theological position, but this is not an ordination exam. He's not being judged on whether his theological opinions are correct. He's being judged on whether he has put together a logical case and whether he has dealt with Scripture. So, just as you have to be aware that there's going to be theological diversity among your examiners, so you should also be aware that there will be theological diversity among the students, and that some allowance should be made for that diversity. There's not a subscription requirement. You don't have to subscribe to Westminster to be a student at our school. Yes.